DW Deutsche Welle Pulse.
It's Juice! See, I just came back from Ghana.
Really?
And I want to share this dance that everyone was doing over there.
What's the dance?
QB tried to show me how to do it. He sat me down in his place.
And what did he say?
And he said to me, Juice!
Hello and welcome to Pulse. I'm Jessie Wingard in Bonn, Germany. We have lots to cram into the show, so let's not waste any time. We'll cycle around Soweto, meet some Afro-Mexicans struggling for recognition, and how does Africa fare in the global social media stakes? All that and more coming up on this jam-packed edition of Pulse.
Now watch me do my zonto, azonto, azonto. Now watch me do my zonto, azonto. We walk over the pain.
The World Wide Web has become an integral part of life for many. In their global overview, the media group We Are Social say more than half of the world's population now uses the internet. And the fastest growing group is, you guessed it, in Africa. With me to break this down is fellow Pulse host and member of the Africa Social Media Desk, Crispin Wakadeo. Crispin, welcome back to the Pulse studio.
Thanks, Jesse.
There's been somewhat of a social media boom in Africa.
Absolutely. Social media is the media in Africa. I was just talking with my colleague when we were coming in today that before the news break out on TV or on radio, people already have it on social media. They have it on Facebook, they have it on WhatsApp. So social media has become the media in Africa.
Now, let's talk some figures here. There's been a 50% boom in social media across Africa. What else do we know?
Well, that's around 170 million users on social media platforms. And that's really staggering if you think about it. WhatsApp, Facebook, Facebook Messenger, these are the platforms that people are using. Figures say that 41% of Facebook users are between the ages of 20 and 29. So a very, very young age group there. 17% are between the ages of 13 to 19. 17%. So again, the age is getting younger and younger. So if you want to reach out to people with information in Africa, social media is the place.
And these are the decision makers of the future. And that must be getting some governments in Africa a little worried, surely.
Absolutely. You're very right there. I mean, if you think about it, in the last few years, we've seen more and more governments trying to block social media when it comes to during election periods or protests, for example. We've seen that in Cameroon. We've seen that in Chad. We've seen that in Zimbabwe, in Uganda. More and more governments are realizing the potential that social media has and the influence that it has on young people. And so they're trying to block this. In Ethiopia recently, we saw also Facebook getting blocked. And to some extent, the entire internet is completely shut down.
People are also not only standing up to state, but also to big business. And we saw that in the last few weeks in South Africa. What happened there?
Well, South Africans have boycotted a call to skip social media use for a day to protest against high data costs, which has ironically seen the hashtag social media blackout trend on Twitter.
Which is incredible in itself. Everybody's saying we're not going online, but yet it was one of the number one trending hashtags globally.
Precisely. It's ironical, but again, they made their point there. They were just saying that, I mean, if you want to start infringing on our rights to go on social media, then we are going to give you a blackout. We're not going to use any of your services. And I think that's also somehow helped them to spread their cause.
Now, it's not just South Africa where there are high data costs. It's across the board, isn't it?
It is. And that's also a challenge to many internet providers across Africa. You find that platforms like YouTube that require a huge data for people to watch videos, hard for people to access. But at the same time, I think the reach of internet or fiber optic internet connection is increasing in Africa. And that helps people to access all the platforms easily and accessibly and cheaply as well. So I think there is progress, but we are still not yet there.
Crispin, I think we should ask our listeners if they've got a comment that they'd like to make about the internet service in their country. Perhaps they could get in contact with us on our Facebook page. That's DW Africa. And they could share their thoughts. Maybe we'll get you back into the studio next week and have a chat about that.
We are looking forward to that anytime.
Absolutely. That again. So DW Africa on Facebook. Leave us a message if you'd like to tell us how the internet is in your country and how you use social media. Crispin Wakadeo from the Africa Social Media Desk and fellow Pulse host. Thank you for joining me
always
in
a
the
pleasure,
studio
Jessie.
Today.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Crispin.
though I have fat thighs, flabby arms, a pot belly still gives good loving.
Soweto is probably the most famous township in South Africa. It's here that a lot of milestones of the struggle against apartheid took place. It's here that two Nobel Prize laureates, Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu, lived in the same street. And it's also here that the change in South Africa's matrix is most visible. The emerging middle class is not keen any longer on getting out of this township as fast as they can. Instead, they want to embrace their culture and community, build nice houses in which they want to live, and find cool places to hang out within Soweto. Our reporter, Kirsten Verter, has visited a true energetic Sowetan who's at the forefront of gaining the township a worldwide reputation by bike.
So my name, Thando, means love. I've got lots and lots of love for everyone.
Thando Mtambo is not only full of love, she's fun. Her big smile exposes a gold tooth and a voice that can be heard, especially from tourists visiting Soweto.
Okay.
So just to make sure that we're all on the same level, same pace, same energy, we're just going to do a countdown together, okay?
Yes.
All right, let's do it.
Five.
No. I need to feel you guys, please. Can we be interactive? All right, let's do it.
Five, four, three, two, one.
All right, 2 hours, let's go.
Thando is a cycle guide. For 6 years now, she's been leading visitors through Soweto and helping them understand the heartbeat of her hood. More often than not, they're very surprised about what they find along the way.
Most people, they really get shocked that the majority of Soweto is, you know, middle class, because we also give them that opportunity to go to underdeveloped area to understand on how other living conditions are. Things like crime as well. That's also one of the big questions that they ask. Are we safe here? Can we carry our cameras? And I'd normally say that please feel free to have your camera, to have everything that you want. At the end of the tour, you come back and you tell me. So I think people, when they get to Soweto, they just get a complete different view and understanding of what Soweto is, which is good.
Just before her tour at Lebo's Soweto Backpackers, there are actually three running every day, Thando takes some time to reflect on what's brought her to the bikes and to a life full of daily interactions with visitors from around the world. Firstly, a gut feeling and dream of how Soweto could become. The Backpackers Hostel was the very first in the area, established in 2003, and has grown into an institution featured in every cool guidebook.
I live 10 minutes walk away from here. So as I was still studying tourism, I used to come here to do my practicals. And that's how I just fell in love with the place. And I ended up, you know, asking if can I come on weekends, you know, just to volunteer as a tourist guide assistant. So that's how I started and ended up doing my own tours, ended up getting a position, which is quite nice.
Thando today is the Backpackers Manager for Tours and Shuttles. She's a perfect example of the determination a lot of young people in Soweto show when it comes to achieving a higher standard than their parents, who were oppressed by apartheid. Thando's parents have now passed away. She herself became a mother at 19, which is fairly standard here in the township, and she still lives with her granny. Her gogo, as they are called around here, is very proud of how Thando has worked her way up.
I had to, you know, sometimes when you look at situations, then they just push you that this is not what I want. I have an idea of what I want. So I had to try to make sure that I make it, you know, even though I didn't complete the whole 3 years because of financial things, you know. But I'm happy that, you know, I'm not regretting it, but I'm still planning that in future I am going to be completing my studies. As a Sowetan, I feel very proud to be sharing the history of where I come from, where my parents are coming from.
What tourists learn during one of Thando's tours is both fun and insightful. How Sowetans live, or how they greet each other with special handshakes. It becomes obvious that living in the most famous and often infamous township of South Africa doesn't have to mean that you give up on yourself.
Some plait, you know, other people's hair, some they do laundry. I think I'm the only one from my friends that I know who is in the tourism industry. Most of them, it's either maybe call center, retail, insurance companies, you know, things like that. And I'm always like, maybe to my other friends, my job is better than yours. Yes, like it's
And you know, for other girls it is also inspiring, but they can't keep up with cycling all the time, you know? I mean, we have had girls who have tried, but it has not been a success because after a certain month they give up because they feel that it's a bit too much, you know? So like, yeah, big up to me doing it for 6 years, yay!
Tando wouldn't think of quitting, nor could she imagine moving out of Soweto. The tours have brought a lot of benefits to the community through jobs, infrastructure and donations. And for Tando, there's no question, things can only get better from here. For DW, this is Kerstin Welter from Soweto, South Africa.
In Soweto, be sure to grab a bike and take a tour. If you know of a young person who's taking the world by storm, get in contact with us. We'd love to hear about them. Head to DW Africa on Facebook and leave us a message. Afro-Mexicans have played a significant role in the development of both Mexico and the US. Most notably in California. But you wouldn't know it when reviewing history books, because this population has largely been ignored. In Mexico, the community is now just being counted, literally. In 2020, for the first time, the Mexican government will officially include black as an option in its national census. That's in spite of the fact that Mexicans of black descent have lived in the country for hundreds of years. To the north, it's not clear how many Afro-Mexicans are living in the United States. But don't count them out either, say two young California filmmakers who have produced what they say is the first documentary about African-Mexicans living in the United States, where there is even less documentation of so-called Blaxicans. Lena Nozizwe reports from Los Angeles.
Chiles, chile de árbol, chile jalapeño.
Salsa done, but there's more to this feast, much more. Jumbo pots of red rice and beans cook on the stove alongside an equally giant pot of nopales or cactus. On a nearby counter, busy hands chop fresh tomatoes into small pieces that will soon dive into the shimmering green stew that will become ensalada de nopales. Outside in the front yard, carne asada and corn tortillas heat up on the grill. The bountiful feast of Mexican food is being prepared at a home about a dozen miles northeast of Los Angeles, California. It's all for a party celebrating 40 days of life for Ian Jordan Castaneda. The 40-day presentation is a Latin tradition known as La Cuarentena. Ana Irojas is both the party's hostess and Ian's mother.
Diga hola.
Hi, sweetie pie.
When she flashes back to her pregnancy, she recalls all the concern directed not at whether she was carrying a boy or a girl, but about the color of baby Ian. She says she faced even more speculation when her first child, Zoe, was born a year and a half ago. Ana Iroha says she believes nonstop visitors just wanted to get a view of her firstborn's hue.
I just felt like they weren't here to see the baby or anything. They were here to see how the baby looked.
And they would look on your Facebook page and tell me.
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of Facebook comments and stuff that would be like, oh, the baby's going to be Yango's color, because they call my husband Yango. Or, oh, your baby's going to be dark, or things like that, which don't bother me. I don't mind that they would say that. But in a way, I kind of felt like, oh my gosh, it's just a baby.
In Zoe and Ian, Ana Irojas and her husband Pedro have brought to life the newest generation of Afro-Mexicans. It's a population virtually unheard of in history books in the U.S. or Mexico. That's precisely what drew filmmakers Liz Mullis and Tiffany Walton to produce Invisible Roots, Afro-Mexicans in Southern California, a documentary short featuring Ana E. Rojas and her husband, Pedro Castaneda.
If I would see him walking down the street, yeah, I wouldn't think he was a Mexican. He would think I'm the prettiest.
The seed of Walton's inspiration to make the film was a photo poster called Tres Hermanas that she first saw in her professor father's office at age 14. Her great-grandfather hailed from the Latin American country of Panama, although Walton identifies as African American.
The poster was a photograph of three little black girls, and I connected with them, you know, on that point, just, you know, three little black girls who look, you know, similar to me, but it said they were from Mexico. And so I was really fascinated with that. I had always been, even as a teenager, I had always been really interested in the African diaspora.
The image of the Tres Hermanas, or three sisters, was captured by African-American photographer Tony Gleaton in Costa Chica, Mexico, in the 1980s, a place that has been traditionally, and to this day, home to the majority of the Afro-Mexicanos living in Mexico. Many members of this community can trace their ancestry back to the estimated 200,000 men and women who were forced into slavery in the 16th and 17th centuries. And for Afro-Mexicans, it's not just a matter of how others identify you. Ana E. Rojas says when it comes to checking an ethnic box on forms, Afro-Mexicans don't have much of a choice.
Like, usually to fill out a form, there's no space to put Afro-Mexican anywhere, so you either have to put Hispanic or African.
Her family moved to the U.S. from Costa Chica, Mexico, when she was only 5 years old. Ana E. Rojas, along with one of her sisters, quickly started getting bullied in school for their genetic heritage. One name classmates called her was Hershey, as in the chocolate bar, and it was not because she was sweet.
We were never just Mexicans, because the other Mexican kids were light-skinned and we were the dark ones, so we were bullied a little bit at school. It was kind of tough because we didn't know what we were.
Filmmakers Liz Mullis and Tiffany Walton documented other instances of persecution in their documentary, including the story of a college student in California.
In the documentary, there's a young man named Ismar, who is also from Santa Ana, and he's quite dark-skinned. And if you just, you know, saw him walking down the street, probably for the most part, you would think that he is just, you know, Black American, African American. He went through, situations where he said he was physically jumped by other young Mexican guys, classmates, who were upset that this Black boy was saying that he was Mexican. And they, you know, it was basically like, how dare you say that you're Mexican? You are Black. So he pretty much by force had to start identifying as Black. It was almost for survival that he had to start identifying as Black.
Ana E. Rojas will have a lot of history to teach her two children as she balances telling them what makes them unique and perhaps even more importantly, what makes them like everybody else. I know your pain, I see your struggle, not just what you feel. Frustration, desperation, more that lead to Robin Stiller. Them streets are ugly, really. Cops is aiming, sure ain't killing. They speak in vain, no shame. It makes me in the fucking ceiling.
Lena Nozizwe reporting there from Los Angeles. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Pulse. We hope you've enjoyed the show and we'd love to hear your feedback. Head to DW Africa on Facebook and leave us a message. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week with another packed edition of Pulse. I'm Jessie Wingard from all of us here at DW. Have a wonderful week ahead.